From Nevada Public Radio, I'm Paul Boger. This is State of Nevada. When you're going into labor, the last thing you want is to think about is how long the drive to the hospital will take. But if you're one of the approximately 300,000 people living in rural Nevada, it's unavoidable. That's because a recently published report from the March of Dimes classified 8 Nevada counties as maternity care deserts, meaning they lack a hospital that provides labor and delivery services. And now that bleak picture is getting worse. Henderson Hospital announced recently its intention to close its maternity ward and neonatal intensive care unit by the end of September, converting those 62 beds into medical surgical space. That hospital was the closest option for expecting mothers living in Boulder City and parts of Henderson. And as a note, Henderson Hospital is a financial contributor to Nevada Public Radio. Its representative did not respond to KNPR's request for comment. Here to talk about how and why we're lagging in maternal care health options is March of Dimes Chief Medical and Health Officer, Michael Warren. Michael, welcome to State of Nevada.
Good morning, Paul. Thanks for having me.
March of Dimes released its annual Nowhere to Go report in mid-August. It showed 8 Nevada counties, all in the middle part of the state, are considered maternity care deserts, meaning they lack labor and delivery units. First off, is it common to see large swaths of a state without access to maternity services?
Well, Paul, what we know is that across the country, 1/3 of counties are maternity care deserts, meaning they lack any obstetric clinicians like an OBGYN, a midwife, or a family physician who delivers babies. And they also lack a place to deliver that baby, like a hospital or a birthing center. So nationally, that number is about 34%. The number in Nevada is close to half of counties. And depending on the state you're in, there is a range. But certainly, it is alarming that that number is high in Nevada.
Around the same number of counties have 0 obstetric clinicians. Why might these types of specialists be choosing not to work in rural areas?
Well, there are a number of reasons why we see these patterns. In some places, there is a very low birth volume, meaning, you know, a fewer babies being born. And so from a business standpoint, maybe not enough to drive enough business to keep an obstetric clinician there. In some places, there may be concerns by clinicians about moving to rural areas, whether that's from a lifestyle standpoint, the ability to find jobs for their spouses or partners and so forth. And what we're seeing in some places is that finances are really driving these decisions, particularly where hospitals are shutting down labor and delivery services. Many of them report not being able to adequately finance those services. And if the hospitals are not going to provide those services, there's not somewhere for those obstetric clinicians to practice.
I want to play a clip from a press conference yesterday hosted by the Nevada Democrats. They organized their press conference criticizing President Trump and Governor Lombardo's health care policies. One speaker, Jody Dominic, is a local pediatric nurse. She talked about how difficult her long drive to see her children in the NICU was. Here's the clip.
That 30 minutes breaks your heart. That 30 minutes is 30 minutes I'm separated from my new baby. That 30 minutes is a delay in getting to them when they need you, when you need to be with your child at the most crucial of times.
The March of Dimes says people in maternity care deserts travel 3 times longer to access this type of care compared to people who live close to obstetric services. In Nevada, according to a July study by industry analyst Becker's Hospital Review, that median drive time is 56 minutes. What happens when maternity care is that hard to get to?
Well, when it comes to maternity care, we know that every minute matters. If you imagine a mom who is in labor, say her water is broken, she's contracting, she's trying to get to a place to deliver her baby. Every minute matters, both for mom's health and that baby's health as it is being delivered, but also for obstetric emergencies. For example, if mom is hemorrhaging or mom is having chest pain or trouble breathing or a severe headache, all of which can be signs of obstetric emergencies, getting to care quickly can matter. And if that drive is close to an hour, that may be minutes lost in terms of being able to get the care that both mom and baby need. I think sometimes when we think about these maternity care deserts, we think, oh, this is just an inconvenience because people have to drive farther. The driving farther is a definite piece of this, but the reality is there are worse outcomes for people who live in these deserts. Moms who live there are less likely to get all the prenatal care they need. They're more likely to give birth preterm to their babies. And in fact, that mom and her baby are more likely to die than those who live in a full access area. So this is not just an inconvenience. This truly can mean life or death.
At the time that your study was published, Nevada had experienced zero labor and delivery unit closures in the last 2 years, but that was just before Henderson Hospital's announcement. Does this mean maternity care in the state has been scarce for years, but not necessarily getting worse on a large scale?
Well, what we know is that this picture is dynamic. And when we look across the country over the last couple of years, nearly 100 labor and delivery units have closed across 35 states. And so what that means is for women and their families living in those states that constantly they've got to be recalibrating and thinking, where will I be able to get prenatal care and postpartum care, and where will I be able to deliver? We know that hospitals all across the country are facing challenges with their workforce, being able to recruit and retain obstetric clinicians, being able to adequately finance maternity care. And so the outlook at this moment is bleak, and we do worry that maternity care deserts are going to increase.
We have about 30 seconds left. What does Nevada need to do to improve care for people living here?
Well, the first thing we need to do is make sure that women know where to get care. And if hospitals are going to be closing, the clinical community, public health community need to come together to make sure women can know where to go for prenatal care, but importantly, when they're going to deliver and do that safely.
That's where we're going to have to leave it. Michael Warren is the chief medical officer for March of Dimes. Michael, thank you so much.
Thank you.
There are solutions on the horizon, however. To talk about a potential one, KMPR's Ann Davis spoke to Scott Barnett, an assistant professor at UNR whose research focuses on determining the causes and solutions to preterm labor, an outcome that can be particularly disastrous for people in maternity care deserts. Here's that conversation.
Scott, welcome to State of Nevada.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
Now, you're currently developing new medications to prevent preterm labor, which work by relaxing the muscles of the uterus and preventing them from going into labor contractions. How is this potential intervention important in a state like Nevada that does have so many maternity care deserts?
Yeah, absolutely. So in the United States in 2024, there were almost 400,000 preterm births. So it's a really significant problem here. In Nevada, about 1 in 9 births are preterm. In 2024, we had 3,500 babies who were born preterm or very preterm in the state there. As a matter of fact, I've got twin preterm boys that were born a few years ago. So I've had some personal experience in understanding what it's actually like to feel that process there. So because so many babies are born preterm, our research in our laboratory is really to focus on trying to prevent babies from being preterm. And this is important because there are actually no FDA-approved drugs right now that can stop labor after it starts. So we have zero therapeutic options. If you go into the ER or the labor and delivery at 25 weeks, your baby has about a 60% chance of dying if it's born, and we don't have current drugs to treat that right there. It doesn't mean that there's not a lot of other things we can do if we can get them there early. We can give them certain drugs to develop their lungs and to ensure that they have every opportunity they can to be as good as possible. But the reality is that we don't have drugs to stop the labor. And in our laboratory, we take a couple different approaches to this here. Right now, we're funded by the National Institutes of Health to develop a new class of drugs that will allow you to give a cocktail of two or more drugs that can stop the labor, but they also will not cross the placenta. The idea being that you can give a drug to the mother without the adverse effects of the baby being exposed to the drug as well.
Okay. And you said that this can be administered even after labor begins. So someone in rural Nevada goes to the hospital, they're in labor. You said that this drug could potentially be given to them then, and it could actually pause labor?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, in reality, we're trying to look at it from two different perspectives here. One is once labor's begun, developing a new tool that can halt labor so that you can carry the pregnancy to term. Of course, that's really important. The other aspect of what we're really trying to work on is what we call prophylaxis. And that's just a term that means that you give the drug before the onset of the disease, in this case, preterm labor. And if we can identify people who are in high-risk populations for preterm labor, then that means that they could have the drug at home, either be taking it in this prophylactic sense, or they can have it on available to them where if they go into labor, they can begin treatment, assuming it's approved by their obstetrician, and kind of mitigate the worst of the labor before they can reach the hospital there. So at the end of the day, it's really kind of a two-pronged approach there. And we're trying to identify these biomarkers that would really indicate someone's at a high risk of spontaneous preterm labor so that they can kind of be put into a group of people that might be able to receive that prophylactic drug.
How far along are you in sort of the developmental process? Is this still in the research process? Have you begun clinical trials? When do you expect this to sort of hit the market for people?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so as you can expect, basic research scientists is a long process here. It costs normally $2 to $4 billion to bring a drug to market for a whole host of reasons, but it's a slow, methodical process here. One of our approaches, which we're trying to do to help speed this, is we're also investigating the repurposing of existing FDA-approved drugs. As you can imagine, developing a drug to give to a mother who is pregnant has all this extra scrutiny, as it should, to ensure that you're not giving something that might harm the fetus there. So it really slows the process to developing these drugs. But we have identified other drugs that are FDA approved and well tolerated during pregnancies that might have these effects to help stop the contractions of the labor. So, that's one arm of what we're doing there. And the reality is that if this continues to prove to be successful for us, it could be just a matter of a few years before this would be in some more substantive clinical trials there.
Scott Barnett is an assistant professor of biochemistry and molecular biology at UNR. Scott, thanks so much for joining me.
I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Like many communities in the American Southwest, prolonged drought is forcing policymakers in Las Vegas and across the country to make tough decisions on how best to mitigate the declining water supply. Just this week, the state filed a lawsuit against the Trump administration's new rules governing how much water states can draw from the Colorado River. Those new regulations, according to officials from the Southern Nevada Water Authority, mean Nevada could see its allocation of the river cut by 71% over the next 10 years. Those cuts come despite years of work by Nevada water managers to conserve the state's already relatively small allotment of the river. For example, in 2021, state lawmakers passed a measure that ostensibly banned all irrigation of so-called non-functional turf. That law officially goes into effect next January. However, a lawsuit is challenging that grass removal program in federal court. Given everything that's going on with the river lately, we thought it would be a good idea to revisit this State of Nevada conversation from May, where I spoke with Kobe Pellegrino, deputy manager of SNWA, and attorney Sam Castor, the lawyer leading the suit against the Water Authority. First, here's Kobe Pellegrino. Kobe, thanks for taking the time to speak with me.
Absolutely.
Talk to me about where this policy that non-functional turf needs to be removed comes from.
As SNWA has managed the community's water supplies, from time to time, we look at our progress on meeting our water conservation goals, what our growth projections are, what Colorado River conditions look like, and decide, do we need to do more? Are we on track? Are we doing the right thing? And around 2020, 2021, we really started to see our demands growing a little bit. And we began to evaluate what additional things could we do to help manage our water demand. And one of the ideas that rose to the top was this idea of non-functional grass being mandated to be removed for the first time. So all of our turf removal programs had functioned on a voluntary basis for over 20 years at that time. But what we found was there were a lot of customers that had grass that had no recreational value, but had a reluctance to remove it or just didn't really care. We have a lot of these properties where ownership isn't local. They're not tied into the local issues. So it seemed like with the conditions we're facing on the Colorado River, it seemed like the next right step for managing the supplies within the tools that we have available to us.
So what's the difference between functional and non-functional turf?
That's a great question. There's actually a whole list of definitions on our website that break it down into a couple different categories. At the simplest terms, I tell somebody is, would you let your kid play soccer there? And if it's a good place for your kid to play soccer, that's functional turf. It doesn't need to be a full-size soccer field. But if they can kick a ball around, it's a flat surface, the ball's not going to run away from them on a slope. If it's you're comfortable with the distance it is from the traffic, and then they're not going to kick their ball out in front of a car, that's functional turf.
Tell me, how is SNWA enforcing or planning to enforce this policy once it goes into full effect next year?
The reality is this bill says that non-functional turf can't be watered after January 1st. We have not identified what the specific enforcement mechanisms will be after January 1st. We do anticipate that there would be something that we would take that would need to apply uniformly across all of our jurisdictions that talks about what happens if you're in violation of the law. The thing that I try in my job to manage this community to is the notion that nothing outdoors grows in this community without irrigation. You don't have to drive very far out of the developed area of this valley to know that creosote, tumbleweeds, that's about anything that's growing without water. So when we look at other communities and what they're able to do to respond to an immediate supply shortage, I'll give an example that Pasadena adopted some regulations for their last serious drought that included not watering traffic circles. If we get to the point where we have to not water something, it's completely dying. There's nothing in this valley, whether it's traffic circles, whether it's parks, whether it's people's front lawns, where if we say cut off the irrigation to that, because that's what we need to do to respond to this drought, that we don't create really severe consequences to our community in terms of our urban canopy, our recreation. So we have to manage our water use ahead of what supply interruptions could be coming. And on the Colorado River right now, there's a significant amount of uncertainty. So my goal in coming up with what we do is to make it so that we have the resources, the tools, and the water demand such that that's what never has to happen. Because if the federal government comes in and cuts us to the point that we have to reduce use below what we're using today, it almost certainly results in some pretty devastating impacts to our outdoor landscapes. This community recycles almost all of its indoor water. So when it comes to the tools that we have, if there's a supply shortage, that really is our outdoor spaces. So the best thing for everyone to do is to be the most responsible as we can with that outdoor water use, the way we plan our community, the way we build going forward, and then managing what's already here to really be responsible to the conditions that we're facing today.
You mentioned the tree canopy. There is an argument, though, that by removing this non-functional turf, SNWA, this law is exacerbating the urban heat island effect. Is there any truth to that? Is there any, what is your response to that?
So I think this is the most striking statistic. There's 263,000 developed acres in this valley. 263,000. The amount of turf left to be removed from this valley is less than 0.5% of that turf. So when you talk about, could that 1,200 acres overcome the urban heat island? There's no possible way. There's 263,000 developed acres, and this is 1,200 acres of non-functional turf. The urban heat island develops because of our streets, our sidewalks, our block walls, what we choose to put on the roof of a building. Any surface that stays hot after the sun goes down, that's the urban heat island. And there's no amount of landscaping that can overcome this, certainly not this 0.5%. But we are recognizing, and we have for many years, even prior to the litigation, that our urban tree canopy is under attack because of sort of the double whammy of urban heat island plus climate change. As we see, like we did in the summer of 2024, where we just have the most 100 degree days on record ever, that our tree canopy is really suffering. And that doesn't matter if those trees are planted in rock, if they're planted in grass, if they're in a converted area. if we have trees that are not desert adapted and it stays hot for a really long time, we're seeing those trees get stressed and die. And we are working alongside several different community partners, as are most of the other municipalities, to get more trees in the valley that are desert adapted and kind of stay ahead of transitioning our urban tree canopy to things that are going to work in the desert and provide the shade that we're all looking for on those hot days.
What do you think most people get wrong when they talk about turf removal or water conservation in Las Vegas?
You know, I think that the biggest, perhaps, misnomer is that it's all rock. And it's not. Our programs require that you have at least 50% ground cover, whether that's like a plant, a shrub, or a tree. There has to be at least 50% ground cover when you complete your conversion. The other thing is just this idea that it's every blade of grass, and that's certainly not true. We know that parks are necessary. We know that they're a big part of our community. I'm a mom. I've raised two kids here. We use our parks. And the thing is, a park can be managed a lot better than a whole bunch of little pieces of grass in people's backyards. And it gets a ton of use. And that's really what we're looking for, is our newer areas to really focus on having accessible parks for everyone, using shade where we can, and really creating that livable desert community that's as water responsible as we can.
Colby Pellegrino, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, Paul.
That was SNWA's Colby Pellegrino speaking to me via Zoom. I also spoke separately with attorney Sam Castor. He's the lawyer leading the lawsuit. Here's what he had to tell me. Sam, thanks for chatting with me.
You bet. Happy to be here.
Sam, why did you decide to file this lawsuit now?
This all started when Las Vegas Valley Water District was charging me several thousand dollars for what they described as excessive use of my water, even though I wasn't excessively using water. I was just watering my yard, and I have five kids in my home. I was getting hit with regular excessive use charges, and I tried to address that with them, and they said that there was no real due process right, but I just had to pay the fee or else they would turn off my water. So that very much bothered me as an attorney. And I actually emailed them and tried to appeal, and they basically said there's no appeal process. You've already exhausted any administrative rights. And so I filed a lawsuit on my own behalf. That started kind of a snowball effect and grew into this wave, if you would, of gathering a lot more who were concerned about how SMWA and the Las Vegas Valley Water District were using this pretense of water conservation to basically take advantage of Las Vegas residents. And I've since learned that they have collected over $100 billion from Las Vegas Valley residents in the name of excessive use fines without really any form of due process or oversight. And then I later found out that they have killed over 100,000 trees in the valley over the last few years by removing the grass over the roots of those trees, all in the name of water conservation, because they claim the grass is useless or non-functional. And I decided that it was time for us to unite Las Vegas against a form of tyranny that's destroying the ecosystem.
All right, break down the suit for me. What are the policies that are actually at issue?
Well, that's what's so crazy about this lawsuit and the law in general, is that SMWA has been misrepresenting the nature of the law. There was a law passed in 2021 and again in 2023 called the Colorado River Conservation Act that said simply that Colorado River water could not be used to water quote-unquote non-functional turf or grass that didn't serve any recreational or residential or beneficial use. That's what's crazy about this whole process, is the SMWA lobbied for that law, and the legislature did not give very clear direction to SMWA about what that term, non-functional, meant. And SMWA went and kind of made up their own rules. They didn't really follow any due process protocol, and they came up with a standard that they felt was descriptive of what was non-functional grass. Our concern is that they've used a good cause, water conservation, to basically just do whatever the heck they want. And they've gone around and, without any oversight, have basically terrorized local residents. They drive around in police cars. They tell people that they shouldn't be using water to water their grass, or they send letters to people and say, your grass is non-functional, like the church that we represent. even though the grass is clearly functional, it's being used. And in the case of the church, it's being used for religious and liturgy and other, you know, congregational purposes. And SNWA doesn't care. They just say, well, we don't have to justify why we're telling you that the grass is non-functional. You just have to pull it out. And if you don't, they threaten that there are going to be fines or some other type of retribution later on. And the crazy thing about all of this is the law doesn't actually say that. The law just says that water from the Colorado River can't be used to water non-functional grass.
You also claim that the policy is causing its own environmental harm. How so? What's the evidence?
The first impact environmentally is that when you stop watering the grass or you rip out the grass, generally what happens is the grass is removed either mechanically or chemically. And in either circumstance, the tree is often stressed by the removal of the grass. But then when it's re-landscaped and the roots are covered with rock or with astroturf, it's very obvious after about a year and a half or 2 years that the tree can't sustain either the weight or the heat of the rock or the astroturf, and it dies. And I have a house that I ripped out the grass and put an astroturf in the tree in front of that house right now. It was about a year and a half ago, the tree is dying. And my neighbor right next door, their tree, same circumstance, astroturf on top, the tree is dying. Another impact that's occurring is because the trees are dying and the grass is being removed, those things act as evaporative coolers for our environment. And last month alone, we were 26 degrees hotter than we have been in prior years. And SNWA likes to try and suggest that that's because of global warming. But the truth is, it's because we've been killing our natural cooling. And there's many states across the United States, East Coast, West Coast, other areas that have done extensive studies of this. And they've found, and we have experts who will say, that when you remove grass, it's actually not non-functional. It provides a cooling effect. It can cool the surrounding area by anywhere from 5 to 10 degrees. But when we remove those things, it makes everything hotter. And that's not a good thing for Vegas. We've oftentimes been viewed as different than Phoenix, for example. I grew up in Arizona. Phoenix doesn't ever cool off at night. There's a lot of heat that just gets absorbed into the ground. Well, that's starting to happen here in Las Vegas. We're basically seeing Las Vegas become Phoenix. The third thing that's happening is we have entomologists who are going to talk about how there's a direct correlation between the deployment of astroturf, which oftentimes will retain some water and increase the propagation of pests. And so that's a really big problem. And between the tree loss, the loss of cooling, and the insects, all of this is making our environment a lot less habitable, a lot less valuable, and it's just destroying our quality of life.
SNWA's policies are rooted in a 2021 law, AB 356, from that state legislative session. Are you hoping that this lawsuit essentially overturns that law?
We're trying to at least find the SNWA's application of that law is unconstitutional because there's no due process among a number of other constitutional concerns. So, for example, when I get a speeding ticket, the fundamental due process says that I get a notice that I violated the law and I get an opportunity to be heard, to be able to say, hey, I shouldn't have gotten that speeding ticket, or hey, the speedometer was off. Here, SNWA is just tagging grass as non-functional, even though it's used by pets or it's used by kids. It's near a playground. It protects trees. It provides cooling. Or in the case of the church, it's actually used for prayer and worship and other things like that. Well, SNWA doesn't provide or afford any due process protection. There's no way for SNWA members or residents here in Las Vegas to say, hey, no, actually that grass is functional. And so that's a pretty gross abuse of the law. The other problem is that AB 356, like I said, doesn't actually define what non-functional is. It lets SNWA define that. And so it gives SNWA the power to be the legislature by defining it, to be the executive arm by going and enforcing it, and then to be the judiciary by going and basically being the final arbiter, the final judge of whether or not the grass is non-functional. And so all of that is a problem. All those are constitutional violations. And so we would like the court to find that AB 356 is unconstitutional as applied by SNWA. And we're reserving the right to suggest that AB 356 is also unconstitutional as it was drafted. And those are some of the things that we're going to have to figure out with the court and the best path for us to be able to ensure that the abuse that SNWA is engaging in doesn't continue to affect, destroy Las Vegas.
Attorney Sam Castor, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And as a note of disclosure, Nevada Public Radio does receive financial support from the Southern Nevada Water Authority. Never mind the failed movie studio tax credit bill, Las Vegas seems to be continuing to support its own film industry. Enter the new Shameless Plug Film Festival. It's run by four women looking to empower other filmmakers, especially those who live in Southern Nevada. Earlier this week, KNPR's Mike Prevatt spoke with a co-founder of the festival's parent company, Eccentric Artists, and one of the filmmakers with a movie featured in the event. Here's that conversation.
Nadine, thank you for speaking with me today.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure being here.
So why did Eccentric Artists decide to start a film festival?
I would say the biggest reason is all of us co-founders all have filmmaking backgrounds. We were all film majors. But beyond that, I guess we kind of have to rewind a little bit. We have this annual festival that we do in the fall. It's sort of a celebration for the Eccentric Artists' anniversary every year, and it's called the Shameless Plug Arts Fest. A small part of it is the film screening that we tend to have at the end of the festival every year. And honestly, having a film festival has been a long time coming. A lot of people have asked us, okay, you have an arts festival, which includes more than one artistic medium. But I think a lot of people were really expecting a film festival from us. We've worked a lot of film festivals, and it was something we've always wanted to do. And after, oh my gosh, how long has it been? 6 years now, we've been working as Eccentric Artists. We decided in this past year that we were going to do it. We were going to do a film fest. And it's really just mostly came out of a place for the love of filmmaking, but also wanting to have a space where we could have a lot of films not only made locally showcased, but also showcase films from around the world and have that also play locally so that more things could come in and out of Las Vegas, if that makes sense.
You know, Eccentric Artists was founded by yourself and three other women of color. I would imagine that inclusion and storytelling by and about marginalized community would be a priority for your company, correct?
Oh, absolutely. I think that was really what helped us kind of motivate ourselves to really put in all our efforts into Eccentric Artists. I think something that we like to say is that we are making our own seat at the table. We're bringing the chair to the table. You know, it's kind of this permission to make space for yourself in an industry where you might not have had space before if you didn't take it upon yourself to create it for you and the people like you.
You know, I get the sense that Eccentric Artist is also a de facto support group for filmmakers, local film industry professionals. It certainly has that feel from how you're describing it. I'm wondering if the people that make up Eccentric Artists, especially the filmmakers, are they getting support from the rest of the film industry and the rest of the creative communities in Las Vegas?
Yes, I mean, sometimes I'm really surprised and overwhelmed with how much support we've gotten throughout the years. And it honestly was not easy at first. It takes a lot, no matter what industry you're starting in, to make a name for yourself. But even at the beginning, when we started Eccentric Artists throughout lockdown, we already got a lot of support from our peers when we were still just doing virtual events. I think we were vastly encouraged by the amount of support we had, not only from the people we knew immediately, you know, whether it was working in film or from film school, but also just a lot of the local businesses.
So let's talk about the film festival. Shameless plug. What's behind the name of the festival? It sounds very tongue-in-cheek.
So the name behind Shameless Plug really just came from this idea that you should be proud to be yourself. You shouldn't have to hide who you are, and therefore you should shamelessly plug yourself and what you do and what you love best.
So if I'm buying a pass and going to the festival this weekend, what am I going to encounter?
We're going to have four blocks that feature a curation of 25 local and international films, 16 of which are local films from Nevada. And one of those four blocks is a special block that we're dedicating to AAPI films. And we chose this theme because it currently aligns with our own journey as we go into a production for our Filipino Gothic short film, Gamu Gamo. And we wanted to, in general, curate a panel that discussed what truly highlights AAPI storytelling throughout the eight featured films in this block. We will also be having what we dubbed the Artist Hub. It's an interactive space designed as like a gathering place for creatives to relax, connect, and engage not only with each other, but with interactive installations that they can check out while they're waiting for the film blocks to begin.
It sounds like this event is equally for people that are creative, people in the industry, and people who just want to watch movies.
Yeah, I mean, we want it to be a place where everybody can enjoy themselves and find what they're looking for. So if they're just there to watch movies that are both local and international, or they're there to meet people that they hopefully can find collaboration with in a future project, or even provide support for, because there's a lot of people that, you know, are willing to support projects. They just need to know that those projects exist. So I think that's something we wanted to help foster with the Shameless Plug Film Fest.
And that's Nadine Gabrielle Natividad. She is the co-founder, chief brand officer, and editor-in-chief. Yes, she wears a lot of hats. At Eccentric Artists, a local film and event production company. One of those events is the first Shameless Plug Film Festival, and that takes place August 29th at 3rd Street in downtown Las Vegas. Nadine, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mike. It's been a pleasure.
And now I'd like to bring in Sofia Mendoza de Lima. She is a recent UNLV graduate and the director of What's There to Celebrate, which will be featured in the AAPI Film Showcase during Shameless Plug. Sofia, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
What got you into filmmaking?
It wasn't necessarily the plan. Originally, I came to UNLV as a theater major, as an actor. You know, I did a lot of theater and everything, but then I found more opportunity through the film program at UNLV, just being an actor, because there's always so many films that need people. I became a film minor as well, and I took more film classes, wrote my first script, which was this film, and I just ran with it.
I want to go back a little bit, but before you were at UNLV, you grew up here in Las Vegas. What made you such a fan of movies as a kid?
I feel like my family went to the theaters a lot, and like whenever I would sit down, just see the trailers coming in, all the upcoming movies, and then all I could really think of is just like, you know, hopefully that'll be me one day, hopefully either as an actor or now a director. Like I was always just wondering like, when will be my turn to see something that I made on a big screen?
So speaking of film, tell us about What's There to Celebrate. What's it about?
So the film is basically about a Mexican-Filipina teenager who just turns 18, but she has a hard time finding reasoning to celebrate her birthday. But after she reminisces on what made her birthday special in the first place, she learns what she should appreciate in her life in order to find meanings in her birthdays again.
Is this film personal in any way? Does it involve you or your family? Is it have any kind of relevance that way?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, when I first wrote the film, I based a lot of the story on my own experience when I turned 18 and how it was kind of the first birthday that I didn't feel like celebrating because I knew that once I turned 18, there's going to be a lot more pressures added on as an adult.
Sophia, is it important to you that you're included in the AAPI program with the film festival? Do you have a sense of, let's call it solidarity with the other filmmakers that you'll be showcasing your work with?
Yeah, absolutely. I feel very honored to even be a part of the festival in the first place. And especially like seeing the other selections for that block, I'm really excited to see, because I also have noticed some other Filipino filmmakers there as well. And I'm really excited to see our culture also be represented in other films as well as my own. And so, yeah.
I get the feeling that there are a good amount of AAPI filmmakers here in Southern Nevada. Is that encouraging to see?
No, absolutely. Especially at UNLV, I had the great chance of working with a lot of other Filipino filmmakers as well. Like, there actually is a pretty big Filipino community at UNLV, and it made me really happy seeing us like together and like working on each other's projects.
And that's Sofia Mendoza de Lima. She's a local filmmaker and actress of both film and stage. And her first directorial effort, What's There to Celebrate, will be featured at the first ever Shameless Plug Film Festival, taking place August 29th at 3rd Street. We'll have a link to more information at kmpr.org. Sofia, thank you so much.
Thank you.
There's no shortage of what to see, hear, and do at any time in Nevada. Back to talk about a few of the best options is KNPR's Mike Privat, who oversees the Arts and Culture Beat for Nevada Public Radio. And a quick note, the Las Vegas Science and Natural History Museum and the Las Vegas Clark County Public Library District are both financial supporters of Nevada Public Radio. Now, let's get into it. Hi, Mike.
Hey, Paul.
You have a packed calendar with three exhibitions for us this week.
Yes. Three exhibitions because September is but a few days away, and soon we're going to be getting all the new theater and dance and opera company seasons. We're going to get a deluge of pre-fall concerts. We're going to get the festivals, given that the weather should be cooling down, hopefully.
And September also brings the start of Hispanic Heritage Month.
Correct. And the Las Vegas Science and Natural History Museum is getting the party started a little early. On September 1st, that's 15 days ahead of the actual start of the month-long commemoration. And the museum's angle on that commemoration is the intersection between the environment and the sociocultural ways of life of Latin America. What they want to say with this exhibition is both are really important on their own and to each other. One aspect of the tact that they're taking involves textiles, and this is an artistic media that doesn't typically get top billing at art museums or gallery openings, but it's crucial to the expression and the customs of so many cultures. And at the museum in September, there's going to be two workshops called Woven Throughout History, and they're led by art instructor Aleida Castro, and she's going to lead visitors to make charro and Mexican floral embroidery patterns. And that's just one breakout bit of programming for that commemoration, and it's all going on until September 30th.
And it sounds like part of the fun is that folks can take what they make home with them.
Paul, they're not only going home with their work, they also are going to have skills for a whole new craft, and hopefully they'll also have a deeper appreciation for traditional Mexican artistry.
All right, moving on from textiles to photography, what's happening over at West Charleston Library?
So I've been thinking a lot about the desert, about how it looks, how it's perceived and spoken about. Ever since I picked up Claire V. Watkins' new book, Yellow Pine, which we discussed with her on this program a month ago, and she writes with very loving words about the Mojave Desert. Similarly, local photographer Melvin Morales seems quite taken with the landscape of Southern Nevada himself. Specifically, he takes his camera out to some of the more obscure areas of the desert in the hopes of capturing, among other things, its vastness and its undisturbed beauty.
I think that's something many of us who love the desert appreciate. But I mean, it's got to take some pretty large works of art to truly capture that beauty.
Yeah, and for his exhibit, which is called Vistas, Beauty of the Desert, and it closes on September 1st. These are large, but they're not giant format prints. And the images themselves are very simple, often with one focal point, and that can vary from the top of a small mountain to a single foregrounded tree. And I read his artist statement, and I get the sense that he sees himself not just as a photographer, but also as a natural historian documenting a place and a time for this slowly evolving place.
Sounds like there's something there for art lovers as well as natural history and science fans. Mm-hmm. All right, on to your third suggestion, and you're really going to have to sell me on this one because it says here that it involves math.
Yeah, at the risk of losing listeners, you can use math to make art. At least David Jenkins has figured out a way to do so. Now, Jenkins, who has been showing his art in Nevada for more than 15 years, he used to be an engineer. And then he learned about fractals and fractal geometry. Now, what's that? It's what complex math looks like beyond the numbers and the letters. I remember when it was first a thing, when I was in college, the computer science kids that I knew already had some form of it, either on their monitor screensavers or in poster form on their wall, which they probably bought at the same place where they bought their bongs.
I think I shared a dorm room with that guy.
Well, his enthusiasm would have had nothing on Jenkins' own fascination for fractals, because this soon consumed him to the point where he left the aerospace world, and in turn, he devoted all of his time manipulating numbers and infinite equations and algorithms to create digital structures in often kaleidoscopic imagery. So, what does that all look like? Well, his exhibit, which is called Beyond Geometry, over at the Clark County Library, will showcase many of his expansive works, and this will go on until September 20th. And note, some of these works took Jenkins up to 40 hours to make, and occasionally, he had to reach out to the developers of the software that he used for assistance or a little tweak of the programming. And I guess when the math isn't mathing, go to the guy who knows the code for the workaround.
Mike, leaving us with words of wisdom. That is all the time we have for this week. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Paul.